Okay, well, welcome everybody to our session on actuaries and non-financial risk. My name is Melinda Howes. I'll be chairing this session. And we have two non-actuaries here to present to us today, who I'll introduce in just a moment. The idea behind this session is a lot of actuaries are now training in enterprise risk management, and so looking at the entire risks of organisations. Now, actuaries at the moment are very skilled in and have deep experience in managing the financial risk of organisations. However, there are two other... Most risk management frameworks you have a look at will divide risks into three key areas, being financial risk, strategic risk, and operational risk, or project risk, it's sometimes termed. So for actuaries to broaden out, for those who are wanting to move from an actuarial role looking just at financial risks to a enterprise risk management role, the idea of this session is to talk through some of the issues that you might come across looking at strategic risk and operational risk, and particularly we're going to look at the implementation of strategy and risks around projects and project management. So we have two eminent speakers here with me today, and both of these gentlemen have done insight sessions for us over recent months, so I thought it would be very interesting to team them up on the podium today. So first of all, to my right, we have Paul Lindberg. Paul's the MD of Lind International Group, an international consultancy focusing on business effectiveness. Paul's noted for his real-world solutions to today's business challenges, and he's a sought-after speaker both in Australia and overseas in the area of business transition. So welcome, Paul. We have Adrian Johnstone. He's an accredited project and program professional with over 15 years' experience working in transformational change. Over that time, he's seen progressive maturation in risk management discipline on many fronts. Through his company's sequential project services, Adrian has identified that aggregated risk in a changing operating landscape is often underestimated, compounding risk levels further. In late 2010, the Institute and Sequential, along with the RMIA, the Risk Management Institution of Australasia, conducted a survey of risk and change professionals titled The Risk of Change. And Adrian, as I said, both Paul and Adrian have presented in insights. We also have, I'm going to call Kent Griffin up onto the panel a little later. Kent's sitting down the front here. For those of you who don't know him, he's an actuary. He's a partner at Ernst & Young in the advisory area. And he's also the convener of the Institute's Risk Management Practice Committee. So welcome to Paul, Adrian and Kent. Just bear with me for one moment. The disadvantage of a parking-style thing is you don't get a desk to put all your stuff on. Okay, so as I mentioned, what we're going to be doing today is really having a look, broadening out from just looking at the financial risks to really looking across at both strategic and operational risk as well. So I might start with some questions for you, Paul. So you've got a slide here which has some quite interesting statistics on it, so I might just put this one up. Can you tell us a little bit about this information on the slide?
Thanks, Melinda. Excuse my voice. I'm recovering from a bit of a cold. My daughter said it was my Bonnie Tyler impersonation, but that shows a little bit of my age. So any of the boomers can explain it to the X and the Ys who's the Bonnie Tyler is, by the way. Yes, I mean... Our research shows that not everybody, believe it or not, does strategic planning. And in fact, of companies that earn in excess of $100 million, which is a fair few, globally, only 92% actually go through a formal strategic planning approach. And that in itself, I think, is interesting. So I'm not quite sure what the other 8% do. But also, I think the most interesting statistic there is, as it says, is that 68% of those 92% do not achieve the outcomes that they actually set down in their strategic planning. So two-thirds of the people, even if they are getting it right in regard to processes, don't necessarily get it right in regard to outcomes.
So So you've got another slide here. And we can see here that there are a number of different areas of risks around strategy. So, you know, to give those who maybe haven't worked in strategy development before or in strategy implementation a bit of a feel for the processes involved. The first one you've got there is developing strategy. So what are some of the common pitfalls or risks that businesses face in developing their strategy?
Believe it or not, it's who turns up in the first instance. And people get a little bit shocked when we talk about that, because who you have at the table in regard to developing your business strategy is quite key. A lot of the times you finish up with people who are business unit leaders or part of the management team, and so you actually have the business management group as opposed to the business leadership group. And I don't know whether people clearly know the distinction between that, but that's actually quite important. So the people who need to be at the table are in fact the people who are shapers in regard to strategy. They need to have explicit expertise in that area. And when I talk about explicit expertise, I'm talking about their not only their abilities, but their personalities and their interest profiling that focuses in on strategy. And you basically, as I said, want the people who are thinking about the development of a strategy, not the people who are going to manage the strategy.
Okay. So let's assume we've now got the strategy developed. The next step, I guess, is to implement it. So what are some of the common risks in implementing strategy, or some of the common pitfalls businesses face? And after you've answered that, this is a double-barreled question. How can you ensure that the strategy that you've implemented is flexible, so it changes with changing conditions?
Well, there's two parts to the question and two parts, obviously, to the answer, in the sense that we need to understand that you have to have a healthy organisation. What we're actually talking about when we talk about organisational health, in fact, the Resilience Report defined that as... And I'll read the ability to translate strategy into action. So that's the translation bit. So when we start to talk about translating, we actually normally look at, you know, the financial part of things. But in fact, on a basic input-output model, things like money and people and the like are in fact just inputs to the strategy. So it's the value add then is how you actually work with those in. So how the strategy shapes that to make sure that you get the quality outcomes that you're looking for. So a lot of people focus in, as I said, on the inputs. So when we start to talk about the implementation, we're now talking about the organisation, we're talking about structures, we're talking about processes, and we're talking about people, not in numbers terms, but people in regard to, you know, the way they look, and in a sense of personality terms, and also the whole culture about how it all fits together there.
So you're saying the way the organisation is structured can help or hinder implementation of strategy?
Yes, certainly. I mean, if I can go back even on to the first question that you asked about some of the pitfalls, if you get I'll give you a good example. About 6-8 months ago, I was involved in a strategic planning session, and in fact, why we got involved, said we need you to help us with our implementation. And in fact, the CEO ran the session and actually had really strong input and was shaping things and in a very strong way. And I actually said at the end of the day to him, I said, "Well, don't you think that, you know, you're pushing things a little bit too far in regard to where you want things to run?" And he sort of was taken back by the whole thing, because basically he had in the whole room a whole heap of yes men. So whatever he was going to say, you know, they were just following through on.
I love that as a CEO. I've been surrounded with yes men. It's fabulous. So you're saying that you need to be able to get the best ideas from all parts of the organisation as part of formulating a strategy.
Yeah, and I think that's where you guys have got a role to play as well. You know, as inputters, you're used to doing analysis and you're used to, you know, putting the numbers up. You're used to doing some diagnostic stuff. So, you know, there's an opportunity there. But I don't know whether, you know, you people are actually brought to the strategic planning table in some shape or form. So, you know, that's the first thing. People have got to have those types of, you know, skill set, including conceptual skills, decision-making skills, decision-making skills. We're not just talking about rational decision-making skills. We're talking about intuitive decision-making skills. Because in a lot of things now, you're moving forward with no precedent. You've got a lot of data, but no precedent to work with those things. So consequently, you need to have some intuitive decision-making skills as opposed to just the rational data skills.
So how about the second part of my question, which was to do with the flexibility of your strategy? I mean, is it set and forget, or what are some of the things that companies do wrong that you see in implementing?
Well, the first thing is that they've got to want to have flexibility. A lot of organisations, you talked about set and forget. A lot of businesses see that if they have a strategy that is flexible, that actually makes them inconsistent. And consequently, they don't build in any flexibility to their strategic plan. I actually like the other way. I actually like where flexibility is very overt. When I read when I go into businesses and read their strategic plan, I like to see words like continuous improvement. I like to see words like we want to be best of breed. We want to be market responsive. That's actually saying we're going to have some flexibility in our business. And also puts everybody on notice that things are going to change around here. It's not the set, not the set and forget. But I actually, when we start to talk about again risks, when we talk about people at the table or cultures or businesses, that's one of the problems that you have in lack of flexibility. We profiled an organisation, actually an Australian organisation. I'm looking around the room. I can't see any of the clients here, so I won't mention their names, but we profiled their senior team, and in fact they're high flyers to step into those senior roles. And actually, I'll read off my notes because I think it's important. So we found in the people that were sitting at the table and potentially sitting at the table were highly conventional, high concrete, pragmatic, skewed, low intuitive, low innovation, low adaptability, low forward planning, high rule following, high focus on winning battles, not war. Now, if that's their culture and that's their leadership culture, I mean, what chances that have you've already bred in inbuilt inflexibility?
So this is interesting, because I was going to get to some of these questions later, but I might ask you now. It sounds like some of these things, like the culture of the organisation that have always been viewed as being very soft and woolly and unmeasurable, it sounds like we have better metrics now to actually go in and sort of measure the culture of an organisation, or what propensity they have then to be able to be flexible or innovative and to be able to deliver strategic outcomes.
Yeah, definitely, and I think that's a real problem in organisations where they think they are, soft skills or soft elements. But yes, there is some measurability around these things, and there are quite some good tools to do that.
Yeah, we might come to that a bit later. So, okay, we're getting a flavour for this now, but so you've got, you're implementing your strategy in actually translating that strategy into action. So it's all very well, you've got a strategy, the management team have agreed or the people around the table have agreed. You've got to now push it down and get it happening in all parts of the organisation. How do you do that? How do you make sure that people at all levels are engaged? And have you seen any examples of where that's done well or done poorly?
Well, the first thing you have to understand is that in any business or organisation, there's an inbuilt operational lag. In fact, the technical term is factor 31, and that's basically inherent in every business of employees, of businesses that have any more than 31 employees. So what that basically means is from when the decision is made and is how does that cascade through the organisation and how does it translate to each level to make sure that each person at each level understands what do I have to do today to make sure that I achieve the 2 or 5 year, what's strategic vision. The Romans understood that. This has been around for a long, long time. They had forms of team communication that worked on that. So that's the first thing, that cascade. The second thing is to make sure that there's an alignment when the people are talking, translating the strategy, they're still aligned. And we've actually found some very interesting, when we do our diagnostics to find out how aligned they are, In fact, the best that we've ever found is from the boardroom to the pointy end of the stick, is that 40% is the best alignment that we've got. And that's over a period now of about 15, 16 years of tracking that. The best example that I can get, which is I find a little bit humorous in the sense that we were doing a job in Australia and we took a vertical slice of the organisation to look at the strategy implementation. And I found myself in Dubbo at an area manager's or regional manager's meeting, and then finished up out with one of the reps out on the road, a logistics organisation. And so I'd been in the meeting where the regional manager had said, this is what we need to do, this is how it's come from head office. And anyhow, when I went around for two or three days with the guy, he was doing something completely different. And I said, what's happening, you know, how come you're not following through on this? He said, listen, mate, I've been here for about 25 years. He said, you know, if we did the stuff that these guys, he'd get fired. He's not a bad bloke, but some of the stuff that he tells us is going, he said, we just get on and do the job that, you know, we really have to do. And in fact, when we did the diagnostics on that, it turned out that from boardroom to what was being implemented was 4.95 years operational lag.
Okay, so we've been talking about organisational culture and the importance of that. What does a good strategic organisational culture look like? How do you minimise that implementation lag, I guess? And how would someone working in strategy or a CRO looking at the risk of the business measure that?
Yeah, well, culture's in the news these days, isn't it? You know, with the ADF. And you know, the definition around culture is the way things are done around here. You know, that's a pretty simple working definition of it. And I think that, you know, culture is just the sum of the behaviours of the people that work in the business. So, you know, if 30 to 40% of what we do every day is due to our knowledge and skills, 60 to 70% due to our motivation, then there's a huge, component that in regard to shaping the way things are. So you might have the right person in the right job, but if they're in the wrong environment or the wrong culture, you know, what they'll do is actually change the situation. They'll react to the environment that they find themselves in that doesn't reach their potential, or they'll leave the job. But the bad news in today's culture is, or today's business culture, is people leave the job but stay employed. You know, they mentally left. So it's the mental absence bit. And the cost of mental absence is actually, again, I read from some of the research, is you know, employees indicate that 20 to 50% of their capacity is not used. 25% of mental absence is an annual cost of US $3 million per 100 employees. That's actually quite old research. That's about 2006 research. So, and 60 to 80% of absences is caused by loss of motivation rather than illness. So that's what we talk about when we talk about mentally, you know, being disconnected with the organisation and the cost. So, yeah.
So a good culture would be one where you see engagement of staff, and is that one of the sort of telltale signs? And what actual, you know, we were mentioning before some of the actual tools you can use to measure this stuff. So can you just... We love analytical tools. We're actuaries. So tell us some of the stuff you can use to measure these kind of woolly concepts.
Well, one that we use globally is called the WEP, the Work Environment Preference Profile. It's got a bit of an Australian skew to it, because actually a part of the global development of this was they brought on people from the University of New South Wales, I think organisational psychologist group, postgraduate group. So there's a little bit of an Australian flavour in there. So, and under that profile, they basically have suggested that the best culture in regard to strategic implementation is a highly cooperative culture with open communication, able to work with a great deal of ambiguity. Quality-wise, it really depends on the organisation, but the focus obviously is around very proactive. That seems pretty common sense stuff, but to now put that, you can, first of all, you can measure where you are in regard to that, which I think is the most important thing, and then secondly, you can develop strategies that will actually make sure that your culture delivers on that.
And then I guess you can measure change over time,
Yep.
Well. Yeah, it's a tracking tool as well.
Okay, so that's a good way of measuring culture, organisational culture. We talked about some of the other things on this slide here as well. Are there? Do you have metrics or tools that can help measure some of those other things as well?
Yeah, well, there's lots of tools around. I think that's the thing that I find quite interesting when I actually speak at conferences and the like, and even when we go into business, is they think these are soft elements. But, you know, there's tools like the Business Impact Survey, Classification Change, WEP, you know, there's a number of those. I think that rather than go into all the tools, I think the important thing to understand that a couple of years ago, I chaired the Asia Business Forum into corporate restructuring, and I did my opening speech was on the three R's of business today, which is restructure, re-engineer, reinvent, and I talked about some of these tools. I was followed up by a number of over the next 3 days with speakers around that came from some pretty high-profile consulting businesses. I won't mention any of those names either. But one of the things that took me back is they referred to these things as unknown risks, you know, these cultural things, and that they referred to them as unknown risks. And that sort of like blew me away, because there was so many tools around that actually can make them, you know, quite known. And I found it interesting, because I know, and this I think leads into the next part nicely, is that if you talk about a project-based organisation, you know, good project-based organisation, they spend 40% of their budget on doing their diagnostics up front to understand these risks. 40% of their budget. And some of those times they actually spend 40% to say, no, we're not going to do the project. So to suggest that their unknown risk is ridiculous, really.
Well, that's probably the perfect lead-in to starting to talk a little more about operational risk, and in particular, talking about project risk. So, Paul's given us that interesting stat, Adrian, around good project-based organisations. Now, you work with organisations to help them with their project implementation. In fact, you've been helping me at the Institute, and also I know you've done some work with ASPA. So how does that fit in with your experience? Does that ring true to you as well?
Very true. Probably the biggest failing in most organisations is that they continue to embark on projects that are unlikely to actually achieve the outcome from the outset. So if more organisations spent more time considering the initiative before they embarked on it, then they'd spend a lot less time with challenges as they go through.
And do you think that, I know we've talked a lot about this, but do you think that organisations are spending, have more of a project focus now in the way they do things than they did in the past?
Absolutely, and there's some loose statistics around that show organisations that are heavily in a project-oriented environment have seen a shift of anywhere up to 80% of their operation away from day-to-day operations or process into a more project-based organisation. That skews depending on the industry that you're sitting in. If you're sitting in Google, then it's probably more like 95% that sits in a project environment. If you're sitting in a financial services firm, it might be more like 60%. But either way, it's become a huge portion.
And how good are we at achieving success in projects?
Bluntly, not very. would be the general stat.
Got some interesting things up here. I'll just put these two points up, so maybe you could talk us through those, which blew me away when I saw them.
Yeah, they're pretty worrying numbers. Although I think if we go back to Paul's point, if you took out all those projects that were never likely to succeed and therefore should never have started, those numbers would improve significantly.
Okay, so the trick is not just to run small projects.
it depends. I think if those numbers come down to projects over 750,000, which would be small for most firms represented here, it's only about 38%, so it's still not a fantastic number. Look, I think the key there is that the focus of organisations needs to move away from being on how much things cost and much more around what the benefit is, ascertaining that the benefit's achievable before they set out, and then focusing on getting there.
So if we are increasingly reliant then on project management for the implementation of strategy, and I think that's sort of the link between what we're saying here. When I sort of conceived this session, I was thinking that strategic risk and operational risk in terms of project, because I guess I've focused on project implementation risk here because I think actuaries understand a lot of the pure operational risks around business administrative systems, that sort of thing. But I thought these would be quite separate topics, but I'm amazed at how similar what you two are saying, coming at the same issue from quite different angles. So, Adrian, from your side, on the project management side, what are the major risks that you've seen on the implementation of strategy in businesses?
Look, they probably break down into a couple of key areas, but the biggest one, almost certainly, and we see it particularly as we're seeing a lot of industry consolidation in financial services, it's becoming much more prevalent, is that as business focuses on its change agenda, what happens in the normal business operations begins to really suffer. So there's major strategic change triggers an operational level risk within the business itself because no one's kind of watching what's happening in the shop. Other big areas of impact focus around the capability and the capacity of the organisations to actually do what they're embarking on.
Too ambitious in your change program?
Too ambitious, and even to go slightly further to say just unrealistic. You know, there are some things that just take time to get done. Having an edict that it will get done by a certain point in time doesn't make it go faster. You know, nine women can't have a baby in 1 month. You know, it just doesn't work. So, you know, there are some things there, and then and we'll talk a little bit more about this later on, but risk management within a change context has been the domain of individual projects for a long time. So each project manager is charged with taking care of the risk relative to their project. Most organisations do a relatively poor job of then aggregating all that risk to say, what's our whole change agenda doing to our enterprise risk profile?
Okay, so I think some of those things you're talking about there with sort of the interaction between risk management and project management within a business, I know these were some of the themes that you drew out with the survey that we jointly did last year, and it was something that your organisation conceived of. We surveyed some institute members, and the RMIA surveyed some of their members as well as part of this. So that risk of change survey, can you take us through, you know, some of what the results were from that, and what were the key things you were trying to discover?
So I think we've got a slide with some stats. So probably to the point I was just making. Of the responding organisations, about 15 organisations, different representatives from within those organisations came back. Across those organisations, as you can see, 40% don't in any way consider aggregated risk across their change portfolio.
By change portfolio, let's just explain the jargon here. What do you exactly mean by that?
So anything that's not a standard business as usual operation. So whether it's running as a project or a program or whether it's some M&A activity, there were some worrying statistics in there that were smaller numbers than those, but a couple of respondents said that their organisations weren't looking at change-related risk or the project side risk at all in M&A activity. They were simply looking at the financial risk to the organisation.
So those 40% of organisations then wouldn't have a change manager type role within the business either, I'd imagine?
Well, it would typically be a project management office function or a project portfolio function, something along those lines. But the maturity of process in most organisations is still to look at that at an explicit individual initiative level rather than then saying, well, if we've got 10 initiatives and they're all moderately risky, what's that doing to our overall operational risk?
So, you've got another stat here on the interaction between risk and project management.
Yeah, this is an interesting one. We see quite a lot of it as we are working in client firms. And simple things like, what's a low-risk initiative? When you go and talk to the risk management people, there are very defined definitions of the term low and what that means in an organisational context, financially, reputationally, by any number of measures. when you talk to the project management office, a low risk means something we don't think will happen. So, you know, if they're not speaking the same language, even if they were to try and aggregate the information, they're not going to get something that's meaningful.
Okay, so there's another result there.
This is a particularly worrying one. Organisations are so financially focused that they are making all of their decisions around how to assess risk relative to an initiative based on how much money they're spending on it. To give you context, most organisations take a spend the least amount possible approach to compliance change. You know, it's not sexy, we don't want to do it, we're being told we have to do it, therefore how do we spend the least amount of money possible? So when you then look at what the risk of the organisation is of getting that wrong, it's huge by comparison to an initiative that might be something as simple as we're going to fit out our new headquarters. That's going to cost a fortune because we're putting in beautiful Herman Miller chairs, but it now is in the maximum risk threshold because the dollar figure is high.
So you're suggesting here that a better way to look at it would be to look at the operational strategic impact and give the yep. high impact projects your time and attention.
Yeah, often we'll find when we're doing reviews with clients, which is to say, well, rather than thinking of the risk in the way you are, let's just take a very kind of simplified view of the world. What happens if it goes wrong? You know, when you start looking at compliance initiatives and you start saying, well, if these go wrong, you don't have a license. Now, if your Herman Miller chairs are a week late, it's probably not the end of the world.
I believe you just spent a fair bit of money for the Europe.
My Herman Miller chair is beautiful. And it was on time. Yeah, look, that last stat there is really just to highlight what, you know, is a bit of a big disconnect where even in organisations where there are quite strong enterprise risk management processes, there are early engagements in the project lifecycle by risk management, often around initiatives that require board approval or those type of things to create a risk assessment, depending on the initiatives, the fund actuary in certain circumstances. May be involved in making a statement relative to that. Yet when it comes time to pushing it live into an operational environment where the entire customer audience might be hugely impacted if it goes even remotely wrong, no one thinks to check with risk that everyone's okay with that.
Okay, so you mentioned actuaries just then. Do you see, or what do you see, I guess, is the opportunity to apply the actuarial skill set in some of these things you've been talking about?
Yeah, to me, I think there's a huge opening for actuaries in a change environment. So whether that's specifically in projects or working alongside of the project capability, really around the ability to measure and aggregate risk. You know, the actuarial skill set lends itself to being able to do that deep diagnosis of what's there, to really understand and comprehend, to model, to bring those capabilities into a change environment means to be able to look at, well, if project A is trying to achieve this outcome with this level of risk, project B and C are trying to achieve something different, when we aggregate the level of risk across those, what does that do to our enterprise risk statement? What does that do to what we're doing on a day-to-day basis? How will the organisation be able to swallow this? So I think there's a lot of opportunity for actuaries there.
So with so much change forecast for
It's very important. I mean, you know, most of the change that we're seeing at the moment is driven out of merger and acquisition type activity. Not only then have you got the change risk profile of one organisation, you're then trying to marry in-flight risk processes from multiple organisations. Traditional models such as using an audit to pick up where are things at with risk are a little flawed in that audits are typically auditing a set of facts, and in a change environment, facts are hard to come by, they're very fluid. So there's a real capability required there to be able to look at information that's in transit or in a state of flux and to make an informed assessment.
All right, thank you. Well, what I might do is do now is I might switch places with you, Ken. Get you up here for a moment and give you the microphone. Then I might steal the microphone. Lovely. Thank you. So I'm going to now walk around and ask random questions of the audience. No, not really. We're on. So, Kent, you've been a CFO and you've also been a CRO, by the way, but as an actuary who's you know, worked with looking at the whole risks of a whole organisation, what are the additional skills that you had to learn to be able to do that in addition to your pure actuarial training?
Okay, that's a fairly broad question. I'll probably start by talking about sort of CFO role, CRO role. I think, and look, people's experiences in different companies are different, I think, depending on the organisation. But my experience certainly was that the moment you get a C in front of your name, you stop being a subject matter expert and you become a generalist. You simply can't be the expert in the big risk that an organisation faces. I think there's a second aspect that when you're dealing with boards and senior management groups and CEOs, you really need to be at the table in terms of contributing to the conversation. So it's not enough to sort of sit there and say, I've analysed this particular risk and I've got this particular view and here are my assumptions and here are all the caveats. That sort of approach doesn't get you at the table very long. The people who are leading the business are interested in ultimately how you're going to get there and really put yourself in a position where you can take leadership and all. And I think what that means is in a CRO role or a CFO role, frankly, I honestly look at the chief actuary role, you end up being a general manager of risk. And then you depend on having around you a very good group of people who are good subject matter experts and help you work in that way. Another thing that I'll sort of probably repeat over and over again is the thing that struck me most in those sort of roles was the dependence on people capability. And I'll come back to this a few different times. In risk management, so here I'm talking about, I'll use some examples probably from the GFC. Anyone who heard me in the session with Ian Mockham the other day will hear me repeat the same comment. I think in risk management, you can put in place a lot of frameworks. You can have governance, you can have all the metrics, you can have the analysis and everything else. But frankly, if you don't have the people capability that can respond when the risks actually occur, everything else you've done really is not effective. I'll give you there's an example in one of the sessions this morning where the example was given as sort of following the plane down with the compliance checklist. During the GFC, I was in a CFO role, and you know, I was running across 8 countries, so you might be able to know this now. I was dealing with an individual who was very experienced sort of person, and we got into an event. Anyone who was in the GFC, if you remember this, around September 2008, markets were diving every which way. We sort of usually woke up in the morning, looked at Bloomberg, and got heart palpitations. And we were trying to look at how to manage a particular part of our asset portfolio. And this person took that on board and about a day into it sort of came back and said, look, got this worked out, we're putting together a project team, we'll have the kickoff meeting at the end of this week, we should have most of the modelling and analysis done in the next 3 to 4 weeks, I should be able to have a paper with some recommendations, we can get it to the board and in about 6 weeks' time we'll have a recommendation. Meanwhile, spreads have just blown out another 100 basis points, equities have just dropped and bonds aren't trading anymore. That was a classic example of where we had all the systems, we had all the processes, we had all the frameworks, all the good bits that you can tick off. But the people capability of actually having someone who can then respond on the day and utilise all those things to manage risk was really, frankly, something I think a little bit, you know, where I was, we overlooked. We didn't really look at that as something we specifically had to train people in. Talking about project risk, I think you get even more of an issue, but it's even more subtle. When you've got an external event like a GFC, and you're watching equity markets crash, you're watching Hang Seng drop from 22,000 to 12,000, there's a very immediate catalyst to taking action. In reality, when you look at various, particularly organisations that are highly project-based, there's a lot of money, a lot of investment that goes into those, not just in terms of pure spend, but also in terms of where it positions the organisation over the coming years. And to make a lot of those initiatives work, you have a lot of motivational behaviour that goes on. People have a big emotional bind into those projects. And it's almost like, you know, one of the particular Anglo-Saxon culture, I have worked in France, but it's slightly different. Anglo-Saxon culture, once that project has momentum, there's a lot of stuff written on this, it's actually very hard to kill bad projects. No matter how obvious it is that the thing is going wrong, there is so much motivation, there is so much emotion in it, and such a drive for success, that in itself can be more damaging than any short-term fall in equity markets. So one of the things that struck me, I was probably a bit slow, so I probably took a few years, was that you could put all these structures in place, and I'm not saying they're not important, they are, the analysis, the metrics, the frameworks, the governance, et cetera, et cetera. But I think we often underestimate our actual people capability in terms of preparing our people to deal with these issues, whether they're the most immediate external events that they have to react to, or indeed it's how to manage a 2-year-long project off the rails. We call it culture, we call it people management, but I don't think we do it as much investment as we probably need.
All right, thanks, Kent. Well, at this point I might actually open it up to questions or comments from the floor, and I'll be the roving microphone. So do we have anyone wants to ask the panel a question? Or can you please identify yourself for the tape?
Martin Constantine from Challenger. A quick question to the first two presenters. Is there evidence that organisations actually learn from failed projects? So you promised you get done in 6 months. This last project was 6 months. Same one before, and they all took a year. Let's make this one a year. Or do you just keep making the same mistakes over again?
I'd love to say there's loads of irrefutable evidence of learning, but sadly, I think there are pockets of that learning. Part of the problem with that is that most projects, as they go on, and this kind of talks to Kent's point just now, projects are measured often by what their output is, not what the end outcome is to the business. So a measure of success of a lot of projects is that it finished. It delivered the output. So because each output is slightly different from each project, people then repeat the same problems. They focus on the outcome, which is we planned to spend X amount to achieve a certain benefit, and that benefit realization measure was more integral in the process than the learning would be a bit sharper.
I can follow on with that a little bit with, I suppose, from a not necessarily strategic, but probably poor project manager. I actually had a telephone call this morning about this, so it's top of my mind. And it's in regard to a $1.2 billion project that we got involved in Queensland. And it's actually the fourth iteration of this project. And the discussion this morning was about the schedule blowing out. And surprise, surprise, people had to break news to the Alliance group. The interesting part about it is that so many people going into this knew that the point when they said the project was over was never even realistic. But to actually get people to do it for the fourth time, they had to give an unrealistic finish date. And so the learning actually was not only didn't they get the learning, they actually were quite culpable in regard to the way they went about managing the schedule to make sure they could get people on board to do it. So that's, to me, that's just straight-out delinquency, let alone poor learning.
Kevin O'Sullivan. Question in relation to the last bullet point there, what unique skills does an actuary bring to Sierra Aurora? I agree that the people is a real key issue, but as the CRO, do you find that your actuarial training in relation to critical thinking, asking hard questions and stuff, is not a... It's definitely of value, And is it a unique actuarial skill, or is it something that anybody can do?
Okay, so the short answer to your question is I think absolutely. The actuarial training, in two ways. I mean, one, it gives you an analytical framework around which to approach problems. And secondly, I think particularly in the financial services area, it gives you a lot of grounding based off the professional subjects, et cetera, and experiences to actually understand the business model and what's driving the business. No, I don't think it's unique. Having said that, I'm also sort of going to stress, I think as actuaries sometimes we undersell ourselves. There isn't any unique profession out there that prepares you to be a CRO or CFO of any financial services organisation that I've been involved with. There are a number of professions that bring different things to the table, and often it's not just down to the training, but the experiences that people have had and the capability that they bring. I think we as actuaries, personal opinion, I think we as actuaries sometimes look for what we do to be grounded firmly in our educational system or firmly in some sort of theoretical background. We often limit ourselves in that way. I don't think other professions do. And I think in doing that, we actually are missing out because we can bring a lot to the table and frankly, people don't expect us to be experts in everything. They expect us to bring an approach of how to think about something.
So, Ken, some sales tips for those people in the room who might be an actuary thinking of applying for a CFO or CRO role, what should their pitch be? How did you get the Guernsey as a CFO? Right place, right time?
Right place, right time. Yeah. Look, I think you do have to... Look, there's a point in your career where... I'll fall back on something I was talking to a graduate about the other day. Maybe this will help me get through the question. I think when you first qualify as an actuary or come out through your qualification, you know, you're heavily grounded in what you've learned. And really an organisation looks to you for the qualifications you have and the potential you have. As you move through your career, you become the sum of a series of experiences. And some people will choose to be subject matter experts, and that's absolutely fantastic. And some people will become general managers, and frankly, whether it's an actuary or an accountant or a lawyer or whatever, you will get those progressions. I think it has to be a willingness to, on the one hand, use your training, use that analytical framework and apply it the best way you can, but you've also got to keep learning. Reality is, as actuaries, you don't just walk out of the university or walk out of the FIA or whatever and just stop learning. Every day you're at work, you learn about how the business is working. You get involved with, in one of the roles I had, I was involved in a number of executive committees. One of them was orientated around product, one was orientated around distribution. Now, am I an expert in distribution? No. But by being in that for a number of years, I got to learn about distribution and was able to bring more and more insights to the table.
So you're saying it's important for actuaries to get exposure to, whenever they can, to those other areas of the business.
You bring those experiences, you participate, and then I think at the end of the day, you've got to be willing to interact with boards and senior management and have an opinion. It's the difference between sort of coming to the table as an advisor versus coming to the table as a leader and saying, here's what I think we should do and why. And I could be right or I could be wrong.
I think the other thing I'd observe, Kent, is you've got to be prepared to back yourself as well. You made a very interesting point there that we've got to change our mindsets from being advisors to being leaders. And for me, I don't see enough actuaries being leaders and trusting their ability to be able to add value. And as Kent rightly said, you've got to look for opportunities. When those opportunities come, you've got to be prepared to take them, and you've got to take a bit of risk and trust your judgment and back yourself.
Just to carry on from that for 1 second, I think to Melinda's original question, take a look at the legal profession would be my tip. The number of people who studied law but who practice law, that ratio would be quite an interesting one. You find that they very quickly, because they're good at arguing a case, they've learnt a core skill set that's very valuable in business, they pick that up and go through business. To Ken's point, bring the capability that you have but look to execute it, not in just risk management or something like that. Just look to execute it constantly.
I think it's interesting because our training as actuaries teaches us, I think our traditional training teaches us to sort of look at a problem and say, well, on the one hand, but then on the other hand. So I guess, and you know, Mike Thornton was making the point, you know, if you're going to, as you have progressed to CRO, you have to perhaps get more definite about, be more willing to be out there. We got any other questions for our panel? Fred?
Oh, sorry, I put my hand up before I listened to the question. I wouldn't pass the exam, but... I just wanted to build on something because you've emphasised the nature of the modern world as containing a large project element in development of strategy. I'm not sure it's all that different from what it was 20 years ago. There always was a large project element, I think. And when I was looking at the questions, my immediate reaction was, we're talking about project management. It's actually very different from the background. They're usually quite unconnected with the background of most actuaries. And yet it's one of the best learning environments that you can think about. By an awful mistake that I'll explain in the bar later, I was actually transferred, on the day I qualified as an actuary, I was transferred into the IT division and became... Yes, it was a bizarre coincidence, but I spent the next 3 or 4 years leading IT teams in development projects, and it was the best thing that could have happened to me. I didn't need to learn any more actuarial stuff, and in the sense that at the end of the 4 years I was able to pick up very quickly with the technical work, but I would never have learned those people skills, such as I have, whatever limited amount there are, but you learn an awful lot in those environments. Perhaps we...
I think project management or the project capability, I think you're right. Over the last 20 years, it's like a lot of things. It's just talked about more. Doesn't necessarily mean there's a lot more of it. I think organisations are increasingly going that way more because that's how they manage funding. So they have business line funding and then they have a bucket of other funding that's used for investment. In terms of projects as a learning environment, look, each project run well, and I'll say run well explicitly, is a little microcosm of business. You know, it has a leader, it has a committee, it has a board, it takes guidance and it seeks to achieve a benefit based on an investment. So they are little businesses, and so everyone in there plays their own role in a business. That doesn't matter whether it's a technology project, whether it's managing a product launch, where that sits. It's a huge learning environment, and I think as actuaries, to inject yourselves into there, the leap is actually a lot smaller than a lot of you might think.
Example that was going through my mind just then, again, in a former life where I was working, this is actually a true story. On the same day, I interacted with two CFOs across an organisation, and in both cases, those CFOs had discovered an issue with retention within their particular businesses. And this actually happened in the space of a morning. In the first meeting that I had, I sort of said to the individual, so you discovered this issue, what are you going to do? And the response was, I am going to go and revisit the actuarial assumptions. So we have lapse rates and clearly this is going to be impacting our policy liabilities and capital numbers, etc. And then, now later on, someone says to me, well, I've got this retention issue, so I wish I asked the same question, so what are you going to do? This response was, well, what I've done is I've organised meetings. Heads of distribution. We're going to do some analysis on where the retention is actually going bad, so which part of the distribution, which customers, etc. And then I'm going to work with them on how we actually try to improve it. So almost identical scenario. Both responses on the surface sound fine, but from a business perspective, the second one is actually the one that a management group wants you to do. The first one makes sense actuarially, but not that helpful all up in the commercial environment. And I think that's the kind of difference. that you need to think about. And that's what actually sells you, as sort of going beyond just being the actuary, the person who actually counts the numbers.
Oh.
Yeah, it's probably a summary point, and it brings it back to strategy. I think when you start to talk about project management, or in fact business management, you know, in project management terms, a lot of people are very well equipped with the disciplines of project management. The thing that I suppose that I see most lacking is the work done in what I call the ideation stage. You know, when the idea is put up, and how, you know, what does that, what does in outcome terms as opposed to output terms, what does that really look like? And so many times we have to revisit that whole, what are you really trying to achieve here, Kite? Because unless you've got that really strongly defined, then in fact, whatever you do after that, you're going to have a cascade error problem. Yeah, you know, if you only got your head around 80% of that, then the best outcome you're ever going to get is only 80%. And of course, and then if you, in implementation, only do 80% of the 80%, then all of a sudden you start to get, you know, down to something, oh, I didn't mean to achieve that. And it comes back to probably the very first slide about why does 68% of them fail. And so having that clarity in regard to, and some people call it vision, but it's more than that, having that clarity that you can, that everybody can, you know, smell, touch, feel, and be really clear on, is quite an important part, and we don't spend very much time on that usually.
So I guess a key take-up for everyone in this room, no matter where you are, what role you are, have within the organisation, as a minimum, you should have a, try and gain a very good understanding of what your organisation's strategy is and how you and your team can really help deliver that. Well, I think you'll agree we've had a very interesting and quite broad-ranging discussion. The aim was to give you a bit of a flavour of some of the other areas of risk that perhaps might have been seen in the past as a little bit woolly and unmeasurable, but also to, which are no longer, as Paul's pointed out, also to try and see where some of the skills of actuaries can be applied in a whole range of different areas, that where our skill set very neatly translates across, as Adrian mentioned. And then I guess Kent gave us the flavour of, well, how do, if I've got a goal to work in a broader risk management role, what are some of the things you might need to think about to position yourself for that? So please join me in thanking the committee, the panel, very much for their insights today.